Tapping and Local Tax Division will come to order. And the first bill on the agenda is House File 0992.
Representative Vanderveer, you want to move your bill?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'll move House File 0992 to for possible consideration in the Property and Local Tax Division report.
And you have no amendments. And to your bill, Representative Vanderveer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Members, this bill is bring it before you today because as we're looking for reform and innovative ways to deal with property tax, I think that it represents an original concept that's been around the Capitol for a number of years, and it's one I think the committee should take a look at and seriously consider. And it basically what it would do is take the property tax and make it subject to and determined by income as the factor in determining the amount paid. And here to explain the concept is from the Senior Federation, my first witness.
Go ahead. Give your name for the tape, if you would, please.
My name is Marlo Hammerston. I'm the chair of the Minnesota Senior Federation Property Tax Committee. I call attention, first of all, to your Department of Revenue analysis. It's a little outdated. The 1.5% of income was what we had back in 2000 when we were basing our data and our computation on the VOS database. The new computations would make it more like 1.95% of household income. And basically what House File 992 does is it changes the definition of tax capacity from the market value of a property to a percentage of the property's household income. Household income is defined in the same terms as is presently used by the Department of Revenue for the determination of property tax refunds. This proposal applies only to homestead properties. Tax policy for all other property classifications remain unchanged. There is no shifting in tax liability from homestead property to any other property classification. The value used as the tax capacity's percentage of household income is set by the state legislature. This allows the value to be changed if circumstances necessitate a change. With the legislature in control, greater stability exists. The large yearly changes in market values found in the present system shall end. The tax rate remains in control of local government. Elected officials and referendum are allowed to increase revenues at the local level by the adjustment of the tax rate. Any tax rate change will be highly visible to the taxpayer and thereby encourage greater citizen participation in local financial decisions. That's the overview of 992. Now, why we need that reformation. In 1895, economist Edwin Seligman called the property tax, quote, the worst tax known in the civilized world, unquote. I see little, if any, improvement in the past 110 years. Seligman said its continued existence is attributable to either ignorance or inertia. It isn't ignorance. The property tax is regularly studied and the results are uniform. There is no relationship between the market value of a property and the property owner's ability to pay the required tax. The problem is inertia. We are not willing to let loose of the semantics of the 1800s and admit we're dealing with an entirely different society, one that requires definitions that meet our 21st century goals. Some find it difficult to accept the 21st century definition of wealth. When Minnesota became a state in 1858, property was a measure of wealth. If you owned twice the land of another, you could raise twice the crops and thereby earn twice the income. Our 1850s society did not have the technology to tax income, so they taxed the obvious, property. The 1850s property tax was in reality an indirect income tax. We are no longer an agrarian society and must recognize that a 50-foot lot in any Minnesota city does not earn income, nor does it equate to wealth. The following quotation comes from the publication Standard on Property Tax Policy by the International Association of Assessing Officers, August 1997. Quote, historically, ownership of property has been highly correlated with and at times was the only measure of wealth. In modern society, however, income is considered the closest measure of ability to pay, and the link between property and wealth has become less obvious. Unquote. Bill Gates is not the wealthiest man in the world because of his property ownership. It is his income that determines his wealth. The culture of Minnesota's government has not yet moved to accept the modern definition of wealth, which makes it impossible for some government to change to a new paradigm in taxation. When a young couple takes out a $200,000 loan, most of us would consider them to be in debt. However, as soon as they invest their money in a home, the assessor proclaims them wealthy and begins taxing them on the market value of their home. They are being taxed on their $200,000 debt as if it is their wealth. We are taxing debt, and that doesn't make sense. Why do we tax something as fundamental as a family's home in this outrageous fashion? With the enactment of House File 992, seniors will not be forced from their homes. Society should recognize that during their working years, Minnesota seniors paid the taxes that built the infrastructure that we all enjoy today. Their taxes built the schools, the roads, the libraries, the parks, and seniors continue to pay taxes today, although with increasing difficulty. It is wrong to knowingly drive seniors from their homes by maintaining an archaic and unfair taxation system. Minnesota does attempt to provide relief for some with the homestead credit and the property tax refund programs. In 2005, these two programs cost an estimate of $451 million without solving the property tax problem. We need to stop throwing money at the problem and simply solve the problem by basing the property tax on a person's ability to pay. In our individual meetings, I have shown you how the state deficit could be cut in half or more by making our property tax system fair. Property tax fairness makes unnecessary the homestead credit and homestead property tax refund programs. And much of the $451 million spent on these programs could be used for deficit reduction. Programs need not be cut. This is not a one-time reduction, but an ongoing saving. And to ignore these savings is to turn a blind eye towards a solution for not only one crisis, but two. And for those of you who fear change in any form, you need not worry. A precedent for local government funding based on income has already been set. The Mall of America and other commercial properties support local government on the basis of income earned at these properties, not the market value of the property. If the income-based system works for the Mega Mall, it should work for Minnesota's homestead property owners as well. One question raised concerning 992 is that some homestead property owners may invent various avoidance schemes. Most of the scenarios I have heard are really problems that exist in the collection of income taxes, not a problem with the mechanics of 992. The time has come to think outside the box. Minnesota needs to become a leader, not a follower, in property tax reform. We need to overcome the inertia that grips our society. So we ask you today to do the right thing for Minnesota homestead property owners, enact House File 992. Thank you.
Representative Vandiver.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I'm not positive, but I think Bill Gates does support this bill. We have.
Did you check on that and get back to us?
We're waiting for his confirmation. But how I'd like to proceed, I think, if we could, is keep Mr. Hammerstein up here until we're sure the committee understands the technical and mechanics in the bill. So if members had questions specifically related to that, and then before we go to witnesses.
Any questions for either Representative Vandiver or Mr. Hammerstein? Representative Lincheski.
Thank you, Chairman Nelson. And Representative Vandiver or Mr. Hammerstein, how is household income defined in the bill? I know it's the bill is saying that we're going to go to a household income system instead of market value, and I know that Mr. Hammerstein and I have met on this piece of legislation a number of times, and he knows that I have some issues in that. How you define income, if it's just a straight up who earns income, you know, there's a whole lot of folks who have wealth to pay their property taxes who may not be income earners. And so some of the concerns I've had on that definition of wealth, well, I understand where you're going with, you know, we don't want to talk about wealth as it relates to property. One of the concerns I've always had is that it becomes a local income tax where the folks who are still earning income and may have very high costs and may have a very tough time paying their property taxes, pay the property taxes of the people who no longer earn income, but may have wealth. And I, you know, I've thought about it over time because I really want to do what Mr. Hammerstein and what, you know, the bill attempts to do here is say that we ought to provide relief on the ability to pay. I agree with that. And that's why we have the property tax refund system and the circuit breaker and targeting and all these other things where we're trying to do that. But part of the current concern I've always had about this is frequently the statement is made that there's no relationship between the value of a home and the income. And where I would disagree with that is when you go to get a home, you know, the bank has to decide how much mortgage you qualify for, and that is based on your income. So while as over time market values can kind of get out of control, you know, you can't go buy a $5 million home if you earn $30,000 a year. I mean, the bank will not let that happen. So it is a factor in as far as how much you actually qualify from a lending perspective. And I would say banks, in fact, qualify people for far too much debt than they should ever be allowed to carry, and that's a problem in American society. But I think there is some relationship between income and the house people are in. I mean, there are exceptions, but there aren't a lot of people in incredible poverty in multi-million dollar homes, and there aren't a lot of, you know, very, very wealthy wealthy individuals in $70,000 homes. You could certainly find some examples, but I don't think that, you know, Mr. Hammerstein would deny that. I think what he's trying to say is for people who are actually now in a position where their property taxes, they paid off their mortgage and they can't even pay their property tax, how can we help them? And I think we all agree with that. The concern I just had with this bill is, you know, how do you define that income? Because, you know, I look at, like, say, my parents. I mean, they paid off their mortgage, you know, forever ago. And now they're property tax is much more than their house payment ever was. I mean, so if their property taxes for the year are $4,000 or $5,000, they have to plan every month to come up with that money, and they're trading off all these things, and they don't even have a mortgage. But I guess the problem I've always had with that is if you take away an incentive for people to plan and save, and you had a whole society going, you know, when we're not earning income, we don't pay property taxes. you know, why would people save to pay their property taxes? And they may live in those homes for another 20 or 30 years. So I know, Representative Vandiver, you have had, you know, you've had some of these concerns as well, and it's always a good discussion piece for the committee, but, you know, how is household income defined? And I'm not one who's willing to just say it's, you know, if you bring home a paycheck. I mean, there are certainly other ways that people have money. So I'm not knowing technically how you're defining income in the bill.
Mr. Hammerstein?
Mr. Chair, Representative Lincheski. Basically, the way it was defined, as I in my explanation did, was based on the PR1M, which is the form you fill out when you participate in the property tax refund program, which is a different, larger amount of income than you put on the first page of your income tax form. And I think our biggest contention between the two of us is, again, our definition of wealth. If this hypothetical couple that I told you about that invested there got a $200,000 loan from somebody, from Grandpa, and they got $200,000 in their pocket, when they invest that in their home, the second they invest that in their home, they're being taxed on $200,000, even though it's a loan and they don't have any equity in it whatsoever. If they would take that $200,000 and invest it in the stock market, I would assume that I would make the statement that they had wealth then. They've got stock in their hands. They don't pay one nickel on that investment of $200,000. As time goes by, that stock might appreciate, and when they sell it, they will pay tax on the appreciation, but they will never, ever pay tax on the original $200,000 investment. Why do we take something like a home where they go into a debt and invest the $200,000, and then we start taxing them on the debt? That's not right. And we're very flexible as far as a definition of income. I mean, we had to come up with something for the bill, and we used the same definition that the Department of Revenue uses for their computation of property tax refund. But I'm sure this organization could come up with a good definition of income. Any organization that can base the amount of LGA aid we give to a city on the number of automobile accidents they have in that town, I'm sure this organization could come up with a good definition of income that would satisfy everybody.
Other questions? Representative Simpson.
I think this is an interesting concept. I guess the one thing that I look at here in looking at what basically we're going to be doing is we're doing a shift, and we're going to be shifting the tax base over onto the commercial property. It seems to me that in Minnesota we're constantly working, trying to come up with ways to bring business into the communities, bring into the state, keep businesses from moving across the river, and with what this proposal will do, I see that really changing the commercial rate considerably. So can you tell me what we're going to do to occupy all these houses that we've saved when we've driven the business out of the communities?
Mr. Hammerstein.
Mr. Chair, Representative Simpson, I assume you came to that conclusion by reading the analysis from the Department of Revenue. Is my correct? They don't know what they're talking about. There's no shift in this to any other property classification. There's going to be shifts within the set of homestead property owners? Yes. Because right now there are some homestead property owners that are paying 0.1% of their income on property taxes. There are some homestead property owners that are paying 20 and 30% of their income towards property taxes. There's going to be a melding between those two, and it's going to come out to be an average. And when I showed this to you and showed you the example of the $150,000 home value, when we get done with it, on our proposal, everybody in that $150,000 home would be paying a flat tax around 2% of their income. there is no shifting to others. That we would collect exactly the same amount of money in that homestead property owner's set of people as we do now. We'd have the same amount of money based on the amount of taxes we collect, as well as using some of that money we're throwing at the problem, the $451 million, to make it neutral for the homes, for the various communities. There is no expansion onto other sets of property.
Thank you.
Other questions for the testifiers? If not, we have some other witnesses. Representative Abrams.
So it's for, Mr. Chairman, so it's for homestead property. What if I decide not to homestead? What if I decide to put it into a qualified personal residence trust owned by my kids? The property isn't homesteaded, the mortgage company isn't going to care, and I rent. What if I just own it and don't homestead it?
Representative Banneker or Mr. Hammerstein?
Mr. Chair, Representative Abrams, the first thing we do is we isolate you from everybody else in the world so that we don't get these things out in the public domain that you can think of, because you've got a mind that surpasses everybody else's mind. And you have ways of doing things that nobody else thought of doing. And I bet if you put your mind to it to make this program better, we would have a marvelous system.
Mr. Chairman, when I used to chair the tax committee, a witness like this would get milk and cookies.
Mr. Chair?
Representative Rucamino.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Representative Vanderbilt. You have a great bill here. But Representative Abrams, Mr. Adams, and he's right. He's right about what he just said about you. But on the actual note, the truth of it, wouldn't it just remain on current property taxes then as a non-residential homestead, which would pay the current property tax rates, which we have, and would still be on our current property tax system then if you chose? I think it would be classified by our assessors as non-residential, residential non-homestead.
Representative Abrams.
Well, Mr. Chairman, Representative Rucavina, you are correct. And this year you're doing better than a broken watch, Representative Rucavina. You're correct more often than twice a day. But what you basically would then have, would be what economists would call the freeloader problem, which is that people would sit around and they would figure out what their taxes would be under 2, 3, 4 different scenarios, and they'd go to the one in which they could absolutely limit their liability. So, Representative Rucavina, you are correct, but you are going to influence a business type and ownership type, and do you really want to put those distortions into the market, or do you want to have relief going directly to the taxpayer in a transparent way? It's a good policy debate, Representative Rucavina, but I kind of go more towards the transparency and not going through the gymnastics.
Well, Mr. Chair, in response to that, first of all, in reference to your insinuation that occasionally I exaggerate, which is the way I took it, I have my fact sheets all right here, and you've never been able to contest them when I bring them up. But that's another point. But I do have to respond to your freeloader statement, because I assume that you're referring, yesterday we had the tax incident study in full committee, and I assume you're referring to those top decile who have the lawyers to right now figure out how to freeload on our tax system, because I can tell you that, the 9,000 households on the bottom of the tax incident study by income decile are not going to be able to sit there and figure out which way they should pay their taxes, be it non-homesteaded, so that they might save $30. I would suspect that this proposal by the Senior Federation would treat those 5 or 6 deciles on the bottom much fairer than they're treated currently, and that, there's probably going to be some shift or something to other classifications. You're right, and Representative Simpson's right. Mm-hmm. But, you know, the reason I like this proposal, and I'm glad that Representative Vanderveer is carrying it, is that it does truly take into account ability to pay even on a property tax system. So, but I appreciate the fact that this year I'm more right at least three times a day instead of twice, Representative Abrams.
Representative Winchesky.
Thank you, Chairman Nelson. And just following up with following Representative Rukavina here. You know, Representative Rukavina, you came in late, and now you're showing Representative Broad your fact sheets, and you're not listening to me.
I can chew gum and talk at the same time.
Oh, yeah? Yeah? Okay, well, you know, we did talk about a little bit about the ability to pay issue, and I think that, you know, Mr. Hammerstein knows that most folks here really do want to get the property tax relief to the people who need it the most. And I think where we've disagreed is, does this actually do that? I have still never been convinced that the property tax refund system isn't the way to do it. You know, it is based on income. So you could take money and dump it into that system, and then you could get everybody at all income levels. And I have those distortion of the market concerns that Representative Abrams has raised, not related to the non-homestead homestead, but one of the things I think about with this bill all the time. Now, if you were a non-income earner, and you wanted to shelter your wealth, and as you've just said, you know, the folks who have the ability to sit and think about how to do that are the people who are going to do it. They tend to be the wealthiest folks. I mean, couldn't you imagine that there would be location decisions? I'm just asking rhetorically for the committee, where people would say, look, you know, and this is all census data we all have in the state of Minnesota. We have it on our districts, on every house district. What percentage of the population is these ages? So you can kind of figure out who's earning income. And you can say, you know what, I'm not going to go locate in that community because, like, everybody there is older. Or I'm going to go to this community where everyone's really young, and then they are going to be mostly income earners. I mean, I'm going to pick Lakeville because everybody's, you know, the average population age is so low that those folks will pick up the tab versus I'm going to go here where this community is aging. Do you see the market distortion in that? I mean, that's part of the problem I see with this is when you start distorting down to the level where people would figure this out. They could actually pick the communities that they would live in relative, because this is based on your net tax capacity, a market value of a city. And then somehow your city, unless I misunderstand it, has to also figure out its total income for its city. So like if you took my city, say, in Bloomington, you'd have to somehow know the household income of your whole city and divide it by your market value. Right? Or do I not understand how this works? I think it's on a city basis, on a taxing jurisdiction basis. So I think there's just a lot of complications, but maybe, I know, Mr. Hammerstein, you've changed, you know, working with all of us because you know we're all nuts and we're moving targets and you're always trying to, you know, keep working with this proposal. So it changes a little bit and you listen to us a lot, you meet with all of us, and we all really do appreciate it, and we know your heart is in the right place, and I hope you think ours is too. It's kind of, you know, it changes a little bit, and maybe I'm not understanding it this year, but I thought a community would have to know its household total income for its city divided by its market value tax capacity, but maybe that's not this proposal, so I apologize if I'm misunderstanding it.
Representative Vanderveer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, Representative Lincheski, with regard to people making decisions, location decisions like you described, I have to tell you they already do that, and to a very large extent, and in fact, I think most of the time. Secondly, Mr. Chair, I think Mr. Hammerstein is in the lead currently for the best I don't know answer in committee after the one to Representative Abrams.
Yeah, I would say so. Other questions for Mr. Hammerstein? Mr. Hammerstein?
Yeah, could I make a comment? Representative Abrams is absolutely correct that there is the possibility that if you didn't like the income way, you could absolutely go to non-homesteaded and pay it the way you do now. That, in my way of thinking, is kind of an advantage, and it kind of shoots down some of the objections that we have that people are going to be moving here or there to avoid the tax. And to Representative Lincheski, I'll agree with Representative Vanderveer that people do that now based on the market value of properties in various. Go to a community where you buy a low-valued home and everybody else is high-valued. That's the same thing. You say you want to give the aid to the people who need it the most. The only trouble with that is that's a subjective judgment that somebody's going to make, and I'm not too sure I'd be happy with the subjective judgment. The better judgment, the better instructions, is the instructions that come with our Constitution. The Constitution says the taxes should be uniform on the same class. Well, when we have people paying 0.1% of their income to support local government and some paying 21% to support local government, that, in my way of thinking, is not constitutional, it is not uniform, and it needs to be changed. And when we talk to assessors about, you know, our market values, they don't say, well, I'll fix it for you. They say, we have nothing to do with that. Go to the legislature. They're the ones in charge of it. Well, here we are.
Other questions for Representative Winchesky?
Thank you, Chairman Nelson. Just, I think you misunderstood me. I just want to, for a point of clarification, Mr. Hammerstein, is it isn't subjective. The property tax refund system is not subjective. It is based on income now. And I think maybe you thought I was talking about something else, but we don't have a subjective system. We have a property tax refund that's based on a very objective, empirical measure that assesses ability to pay. So I think you misunderstood me.
Probably a second time, too. Representative Vannevere, do you have other witnesses you'd like to call up here at this time?
Yes, Mr. Chair, and I think if Mr. Cox could come up now, that would be
great. Wayne Cox, welcome to the committee, and please identify yourself for the tape, please, sir.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members. I'm Wayne Cox. I'm Executive Director of Minnesota Citizens for Tax Justice, and we're a tax and budget research organization here in St. Paul whose members include the Minnesota AFL-CIO, a number of other civic labor and religious organizations. Mr. Chairman, I'm here to speak in favor of the legislation proposed by Representative Vannevere. Seems to me that it tackles a problem that our current system fails to address, namely the problem of those homeowners for whom the property tax is a portion of their income is very great, even after the application of the homeowner's circuit breaker. That's a problem that the legislature has struggled with over the years and has tried to improve and has improved the circuit breaker over the years, but there's still a fairly significant group of people tending to be more seniors who are sort of property value rich and income poor, and the circuit breaker really doesn't address their circumstance to the extent that it really ought to. So this is a look at that problem and applying a more fundamental type of solution. I agree with some of the concerns expressed by Representative Winchesky and Representative Abrams, that if you do a big change like this, you want to do it with an awful lot of foresight and due diligence with respect to the potential ways the system could be gamed under a new system, and you'd want to do that with an awful lot of pretty thoughtful legal analysis to do that. I don't know that the bill or Representative Vannevere has attempted to really look at it, all of those type of issues at the depth that they would be required, but there certainly is the opportunity as this legislation would move forward to have some strong analysis and improvement made if it were required. But there are the potential for pitfalls that one would have to look at. I think the other concern one would want to look at would be to try to make sure that the net effect of this wasn't a radical change really one way or the other in the basic resources that go from the property tax to provide for local government services. Seems to me you'd want to have this bill operate in a fashion that you wouldn't use it to necessarily provide a lot of new revenue to the cities or counties, but you wouldn't want to have a circumstance where they would be jeopardized in terms of their capacity to maintain current services either. if you want to deal with revenue issues, assuming you can deal with that in local government and otherwise. But this could potentially have an effect on their ability to maintain their services, and to the extent that it did, I think you'd want to look carefully to make sure that it was crafted in a way that did not have strong effects one way or the other in terms of changing that basic financing setup. So we think that this is an idea worthy of consideration. It's an approach that, with a lot of skill and care, potentially could be done in a way that would be beneficial to the state, take care of a problem that we haven't seemed to take care of very well with our in our current system, but that if it were to be undertaken, ought to be undertaken with a great deal of skill and crafting to make sure that you've thought through very carefully any potential downsides to the legislation.
Thank you. Any questions for Mr. Cox? Representative Krenke.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Cox, when you say that you feel there's additional study and additional considerations to be made on this topic, specifically, I guess, what are the areas that you feel are most concerned as you look at this proposal, and how would you propose that we go about undertaking those types of study?
Well, the main concern, I think, is the one that was brought up by Representative Abrams, that there's a potential to game the system. I'm not a lawyer, and so I don't know that the example I want to give now is a valid example or not, but it gives you the kind of drift of the way the thing potentially could be gamed. Let's say I have very high income and I live in a property that has very high property value. I pay a high property value on it. I pay a relatively high property tax on it now, but I would pay a lot more if it were based on my income. It may be possible for an individual in that circumstance to create an alternative ownership arrangement. It may be possible for that person in that circumstance to create an alternative potentially income arrangement. It's something that you would want to think through very carefully. Now, I think that on that, the problem would be probably end up being a fairly small one as a portion of your overall revenue and whatnot, but it'd be nonetheless one that you would want to think through very carefully and make sure that you've dealt with. It would be potentially could be sort of analogous to the foreign operating corporations kind of concept, where you could sort of farm out ownership just so it was less income. In other words, there are ways that hold the potential of gaming that you'd want to look very carefully in. And it may be something what often happens to this is you craft the law as best you can, and then you find out a year later that they gamed it, and then you go back and you make the improvement. So, I mean, it's always a thing where you constantly continue to have to attend to.
Thank you.
Other questions? Representative Marquardt.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and for the author of the bill. It's something Representative Abrams had brought up, where we're talking about, you know, this applies to homestead property. So you have the non-homestead property and you have the commercial business properties. Does that mean that cities would have to compute two different types of tax capacities, one based on market value and one based on income tax? And let's say a city, for example, needed $100,000. How would they decide what tax rate would be placed on the market value portion and what would be the tax rate on the income tax portion? How would that work out?
Representative Vandiver.
Mr. Chair and Representative Marquardt, I think I would ask Ms. Baker or Mr. Hines if they'd...
Mr. Hines?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Marquardt, the way this proposal would work is that there would be the two types of tax capacity, the one from homesteads that is based on the income and the one from other types of property, which is based on the property value. get added together, so you get a total tax capacity for the jurisdiction as we do now. And then there would be a single tax rate computed that derives the revenues that the local government needs to operate as it does now. And so you would have a single tax rate that would apply to the tax capacity on a non-homestead property applied to the market value times whatever their class rate, and on a homestead times their income times the factor that's in the bill now, 1.5%, or as Mr. Hamerson suggested, maybe 1.95% being a better number. But there is just one single total tax capacity from adding the two pieces, the two types of tax capacity together.
Mr. Chair?
Mr. Representative Markford.
Yeah, and if I could, maybe Mr. Hines could answer this, but if you were to combine those, what would be the impact? I mean, it doesn't seem like you're putting, you know, it's apples and oranges going together. What would be the impact on homeowners?
Mr. Hines.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Markwart, of course, part of the difficulty of sort of developing this proposal is trying to determine what percentage of income you need to get to the same amount of tax capacity that you're getting now from homes. But obviously, if you know the amount of income there is in households in the state, you can figure out what percentage gets you to the exact same amount of net tax capacity that you have from homesteads in the state. There is a number that gets you to that point. Now, the distribution of that homestead tax capacity would be different under the new system and the old, but you could certainly get to a point where they're the same, and I think that's what Mr. Hamerson is trying to get to, find that number to where they're the same statewide. But it's not necessarily the same district by district.
Representative Vanderveer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I would have another question for Mr. Hines relating to the shift to commercial industrial that the revenue analysis points out.
Mr. Hines?
Mr. Hines?
I'm sorry,
I'm wondering if you could give the committee some idea. The revenue analysis shows about a 20% shift to commercial industrial with this bill, and I'm wondering, with the positive fiscal note, is there anywhere near enough money to mitigate some of that?
Mr. Hines?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Vanderveer, I believe that the person who actually did the revenue analysis is on vacation, so I wasn't able to talk to him directly. I believe that he did not incorporate the $280 million aid into the analysis, which would offset some of that, but not nearly 21%. I think that Mr. Hamerson suggested to me that he would, you know, he would bump that 1.5% up based on later information, which would go a long way towards probably reducing the homestead break and reducing the extra shift on to CI. But there's lots of unknowns about this, and that the effect of that $280 million aid program is one of them.
You have other witnesses, Representative Vanderveer?
Yes, I do, Mr. Chair. And Mr. Les Restinen, I believe.
Mr. Restinen?
Did I pronounce that right?
Restinen.
Welcome. Please identify yourself for the tape, Mr. Restinen.
Mr. Chair and the body here. My name is Les Restinen. I'm from Becker County, Wolf Lake Township. I'm also a member of the Becker County Taxpayer Association. And I've been hearing all this discussion, but I don't hear why the system is broken. I'm going to tell you why it's broken, at least why it's broken in counties that don't have true county or countywide assessing, or where the assessors are running rampant. House File 922 is a fresh approach to replacing Minnesota's archaic property tax system. Homeowners presently face unlimited taxation simply because there is no limit to the percentage of a homeowner's income subject to property tax. That's important. It took over 80 years for Minnesota to divest itself of the much-abused personal property tax. Now we need to realize that our property tax is based on those same societal factors of the 1800s market value system, which is just as outdated as our personal property taxation system was. I am a retired IRS employee with 30 years of tax administration experience in metropolitan and outstate Minnesota. We retired, my wife and I retired in 1990 into rural Becker County. To our dismay, we have encountered discrimination and favoritism at both township and county levels, which House File 922 could alleviate. Tax administration at the federal level mandates rotation of employee territories every 3 years. Unheard of in the present assessor system we have here. They're not allowed, in other words, federal employees, they're not allowed to audit their relatives, nor is nepotism permitted. It certainly is in the system we have now. These are common sense employment requirements that are totally ignored under the current property tax system. House File 922 can address some of these elementary issues, these abusive issues. House File 922 will do justice for fair taxation that the property tax refund and homestead credit have been unable to resolve statewide and in Becker County. For example, a Wolf Lake Township, listen carefully, 15-acre parcel of land, a point out on a lake jutting into Pickerel Lake, has a 16-foot by 32-foot log cabin built in the year 2000 and with a 32-foot porch, is valued at $15,999 in the year 2005. Total valuation for this 15 acres of land out there into the lake, which is supposed to be assessed at a factor 15% higher than normal lakeshore, is the total valuation of the property is $89,000. It is used only for recreational purposes, but believe it or not, it is classified as agricultural homestead, and on top of that, it's even eligible for property tax refund. Not right. The county assessor approves this classification. After all, it's for his uncle and his cousin's lake property. His uncle is also the Wolf Lake Township assessor of the past 29 years, who assesses himself, his sons, his son-in-laws, grandchildren, nieces, and nephews. And I have a copy of this field card for your examination, so don't anybody suggest that I am taking and speak not knowing what I'm talking about, because it's right up there in my folder. See? In other words, don't you agree the system is broken? And that's, you're going to hear this word broken more than once in this presentation. Funding local government from the real estate market and an assessor's valuation is totally unrealistic. Yet our archaic property system relies on assessment valuations. House File 922 presents Minnesotans an equality factor by eliminating assessors for homestead property. There is provable corruption in assessment valuations by some township officers and county commissioners, and not just in Becker County. I'm afraid that's pretty well rampant. For instance, a county commissioner whose height of land, lake property, has 2,800 front feet of lakeshore. It was valued at $82,000 in the year 2000. And when the Becker County Taxpayer Association started putting pressure on these kind of valuations, guess what it is now? The property in 2003 was already valued at $458,000. That lady, or that person, was a county assessor for something like 12 years. Imagine the break she was getting, and imagine the difference that other people, other taxpayers like myself and some of the members that are here with us, we had to make up the difference. There's got to be a better way than this. There just absolutely has to be. And I have other field cards that can show favoritism as well as discrimination. And if you don't know what a field card, printout and a field card are one and the same. They show you, they have the breakdown of the valuation of the property, every building that's on the place and everything else. Because there is inaccuracy in assessments and accountability is lacking in some counties, then obviously the property tax system is broken, like I said before. It's broken. Omissions and errors in acreage breakdown and in building sizes and actual counts are a fact that has been proven by reviewing fuel cards in Becker County. I am also a recently retired certified Minnesota appraiser with 4 years of assessing in Becker County as basis for this testimony of a failed property tax system. I followed people, an assessor, for instance, who claimed that he made 125 fuel calls in one day, stretching from Runeberg Township to Holmesville Township, and the two townships are 31 miles apart at the nearest point. It's impossible. This isn't assessing. This is just driving by, field by, or whatever. And we're talking about people who are being forced out of their homes. Just 2 years ago in Cormorant Township in Becker County, the Township Equalization Board suggested that property values be lowered for a widow whose house hadn't been improved on for years and years and years. Guess what? The county assessor went out there, looked at the property. The lady is upset. He tells the lady, he says, "Lady, if you don't like it, sell it and move into a nursing home or whatever other provisions you can make." No, that's not. That's just absolutely ridiculous. Needless to say, the Cormorant Township Board actually went in unity, in body, to the county assessor's meeting and suggested that this person be fired, but they did not do that. See, he's still there. I endorse House File 922, knowing that House File 922 will not only eliminate abusive and questionable values, it will also eliminate these costly refund expenses and the cost factor of homestead assessing. I tried to read what House File 922 is, and I've read what the previous year's provisions were. And so I thank you for listening, and I'm open for questions, and I think I can answer them if you're talking about assessing, because I have been an assessor and just retired a couple years ago, for that matter. And the only reason I became an assessor was simply because no one would tell me how the system worked. So my wife finally suggested and said, "Well, what can you do? Go and get your license," and I don't like to go on a bus holiday after retiring from the IRS, but I did it.
Good to listen to your wife, Mr. Resterman. Questions for Mr. Resterman?
Mr. Chair.
Representative Rokavina.
Herra Ristonen, kuinka sä mennä? Sinulla on hyvä suomalainen nimi. Oh, joo, so.
Nice name, verbal volleyball.
So, Mr. Ristonen, I told him he had a nice Finnish name, and I asked him what he was doing. So. Now, we had the assessors in here, you know, their organization a few weeks ago. And of course, they claim that, you know, they're very professional, and there's no... I asked them, I think, members, was it how much is science, how much is math, and how much is vindictiveness? And they told me that I was way out of line, but you seem to think that maybe I, like a broken watch, I was right at least once that day. So, these anecdotal things you're talking about in Becker County, or does this kind of stuff happen?
Let me answer that. There's a Minnesota Association of Assessing Officers. They have a magazine that they put out quarterly. If you read that, in there you're going to find out that they admit that there are problems in assessing. And I have copies for the last 3, 4, 5 years, because I have been a member also of the Minnesota Association of Assessing. And you have to remember, I heard about these people coming and testifying here a couple weeks ago. And I also realized that every last one of these people were from metro area and also from Cass County was one of them, right?
Yeah.
Okay, yes. Cass County has 2 county assessing. All of the assessing is done from the assessor's office. In other words, there is no local assessor. And here's where the problem comes statewide in most counties that do not have this type of assessing system in there. You have local assessors who are hired by townships. And townships are bad news as far as I'm concerned. I didn't used to think that, but they are, really. And some of them are very, very political, and some of them are actually nothing but slicks. They're run by families. We have a township, a Wolf Lake Township, where I live in. Believe it or not, one family, a big dairy farm operation, there's 5 brothers. There are over 60
children and live with those five brothers, and they control who is elected and who is not elected in the township. But this isn't just true in Wolf Lake Township. This is true in a lot of other townships are nothing but cliques run by families, and they do their thing, and they have they're protecting their interests.
And so, Mr. Chair, I'm curious to Mr. Ritz, then, and if when you were an assessor, also Rehelinen, or were you vindictive too?
I work for Internal Revenue Service, and by golly, we follow the law. And that's, in fact, I think that, and I wholeheartedly believe that there weren't any IRS employees who would actually show favoritism or anything like that.
And
we
so
have to rotate every 3 years. How could we, you know, we have somebody following behind us. When you have an assessor that's been there for 28 years, you know, there's something wrong. And how can you justify having assessors assessing their own families and even themselves? I mean, I just...
Yeah.
And
this last question, in your opinion, as a former assessor, you think also 992, at least on the homestead, is going to get rid of this
there wouldn't be any reason for some of these games that are being played, you know.
Okay.
Other questions? Representative Winchesky?
Thank you, Chairman Nelson, and Representative Rukavina, and to the witness. It's really a joy to listen to you, too.
Finn is a beautiful language, and I'm not Finn, of course, but it's an agglomerative language. It's not Indo-European. They keep adding things on. You get Finnish words this long, see, and it means I put something on the table or something like that, you know, instead of it being separate words. It's kind of neat.
And truly, it is very...
Representative Winchesky.
Very nice to listen to. And you know, the discussion you're having about assessing, and I can hear the passion there, and we've heard this repeatedly, that there are assessment problems in different parts of the state. I do, to the bill, though, want to say that I was just sort of whispering here with Representative Marquardt, and I think that if you were deciding what taxes people were paying on income, you wouldn't need an assessment for the property. That's true. But while you maybe could get rid of assessors, you'd still have appraisals because the bank would need them, you'd need them for sales, I mean, you'd need them for other purposes. So you're still going to have kind of a market valuation. You're not going to get rid of that. Yeah. Well, and you need it for homesteads too, because I don't know how you'd sell a house. The bank needs to appraise it.
You have to hire an appraiser. I mean, right. Usually your real estate agent, Representative Lincheski, does some appraising. They don't go by your market value when you...
They're close.
Yeah.
Representative Vandiver.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Lincheski, we get this, and an appraiser, too, and we get this asked of us all the time. There is no relationship between an appraisal for the bank and an assessor's function. They're not... the appraisals from bank appraisals and those type of appraisals are confidential, and they're just used by the client. And similarly, you do not need, and most people don't get an appraisal before they sell their property until the time of the mortgage. When the buyer applies for the mortgage, that's when a private appraisal comes into play. And again, that's confidential, and it's they do get the CMV, the assessor does, but other than that, but that again has nothing to do with the private appraisal process that goes on.
Representative Simpson, and then Representative Vandiver. I see you got about five more witnesses. Representative Simpson.
I'd just like to, Mr. Chair, thank Mr. Resident for coming down today. He is the resident of one of my fine districts, and he is certainly passionate about his endeavor here, so thank you for coming down, Les.
It's good to know you got elected, Representative Simpson.
Thank you.
Representative Vandiver.
I also have copies of my presentation, so you won't forget.
We would like that, please, sir. Representative Vandiver, your next witness.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and we'll ask them to...
Mr. Chairman?
Yes, Representative Lanning?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I would like to hear more testimony, obviously, but I wanted to let you know that I have some out-of-town people here to testify for our bill, which is up next. Thank you.
Okay. So we should move that along then, Representative.
Yeah, we should be able to finish up pretty quick, Mr. Chair. There's a jurist? Mr. I think the rest of the witnesses can hold it to a minute or two.
If we could have all the witnesses kind of keep it short, and same way with the questions. Identify yourself for the tape, please, and then begin.
My name is Yoris Chariskas. I live in Hennepin County, Minneapolis, and I have property in Dodge County as well. In the beginning, Marlo quoted a phrase from Seligman, and I have the book. If anybody interested, I have that paragraph where it states that the property tax is one of the most outrageous taxes in the civilized world. The assessment process that I have been aggrieved by, it doesn't apply to seniors only. I was exposed to this atrocious system 35 years ago. Ever since then, I have been interested in that. When I listen to the arguments or the questions, I'm flabbergasted. To me, it sounds like the tail is wagging the dog. It's a huge problem, and nobody's really looking at it. And when they talk about finance, I understand you have to finance the local government, and I'm all for it. But I just got yesterday my property tax statement, and I wish everybody would look at it. I also get one from the Todd County, and I'll read you a couple lines from it. It says, your property tax and how it is reduced by the state. My property is liable for over $8,000 to my local government to function. But the state is reducing it by over $4,000. Where is that money coming from? It's coming from our income tax, isn't it? We are bickering about less than 50% in Hennepin County, and in Dodge County, the same line is 75% comes from the state to subsidize the local government. There we're bickering about 25%. Here are we are bickering about a minor impact, and Representative Wodzinski's comment about, well, yes, you can afford a house if you buy it. Yes, I could afford a house when I bought it 35 years ago. But today, I can't afford the same house. And because somebody, the artificially inflated property values. And I am, like I said earlier to someone, this bill has my 1,000,000% support, not just 100% support, but 1,000,000% support. It is an outrageous system we have now, and it should be changed. Thank you. Any questions?
Representative Vanderveer, your next one?
That's the only other ones that I know of, Mr. Chair.
Then I'll start with Leila Schirmeister. Alan Walgren. The page is putting your handouts. Please identify yourself for the tape and proceed.
My name is Al Walgren. I'm from Lindstrom. My wife and I are both just concerned citizens. We're not really a member of any of the groups that have been here. I'm aware of Senior Federation, but not really part of a member. We started building a house in Lindstrom in late 2001. We got our first tax statement in roughly March 2002. And looking at that statement, the assessor had our property at something like $200,000 or 35% over what I knew the costs were going to be when we were finished. It was that experience that brought us both into this field of looking at where are the property taxes coming from, where are they going, and how do they develop that tax. We went to the assessor's window And an hour and a half later, after talking to four people, we had no more idea how they developed the property tax that we had than when we arrived. They said, well, your house is 56% complete, so we divide this number by 56% and we get this number. Then we multiply it by 56% to get the other number. We went back and forth around that circle for an hour and a half. We got absolutely nowhere. Since then, my wife has probably put in 200 hours looking into it. I've put in 600 or 700 hours. Now, is that efficient time? No, it's as inefficient as it can be. We have met with the Chisago County Assessor several times, the Lindstrom County Board of Equalization, the Chisago County Board of Equalization, our Chisago County Commissioner, several members of the Department of Revenue, Tax Court Administration, Chisago County Attorney's Office, Minnesota House Research, and members of the legislature. Everyone has been very polite to us, but we have received essentially no information that is significant information as to what, in fact, is going on in the system. So in there, where comes that 500, 600, 700 hours of finding out how it works? And the issue I would like to pick up and talk today, A, I agree that the system is broken beyond comprehension, but I'd like to talk about the sales ratio. I assume that's familiar to most people. What I've included in the packet are a list, or a sales ratio study, I should say, of partial Chisago County, 2003, Lakeland, which is part of Washington County, again 2003, a single summary sheet for St. Louis County, which is, I've circled two properties, and then a partial for Ramsey County, which is 2004. Now the 2003 sales ratios are Department of Revenue information. It's their hard numbers. The Ramsey County are my numbers in the sense that if we wait for the Department of Revenue to do that study, it won't be out until May 2006. And I'd rather talk about it as current events than I would history. Now, if you look at those numbers, you will see that the sales ratios in Chisago County vary from roughly 40% to 120%. In other words, the assessor is valuing some property at 40% of what it's worth and some property at 120%. And we're talking estimated market value. That is the number on which your tax is based. So assuming... it's about three times in Chisago County. In Lakeland, it's about double, 51 to 100. St. Louis County, it was from 41% to 180%, 4.5 times. So if someone in St. Louis County, assuming these were relatively similar homes, which I don't really know, but if the one on the low end paid $100,000 tax, the person on the 180 would pay $4,500 tax for the same value of property. Now, this is true of Ramsey County. It's about double. And so looking at this, it appears that the assessment system is absolutely broken. The assessors are running at least double from the low end where they're assessing at half the value to the high end where they're assessing at anywhere from 120 to 130%. Now, the past Sunday, there was an article in St. Paul Pioneer Press that had to do with Forest Lake. It had to do with some people that were apparently fairly unhappy with an assessment on some townhomes, and apparently they talked to each other because, as I understand it, these hadn't been sold. And that difference was 25% between the low assessment and the high assessment. These people were, I guess, expressing genuine anger at how can we have this difference? But that was only 25%. Not 100% or 400% as I'm seeing in these other records. I don't know that there's any way to tinker with the system to improve it. It's based on opinion of the assessor. Now, the assessor that did our house and came up with $200,000 over, which is 35% over, essentially couldn't read the drawings of the house. The square footage on the house was high by a rather large number, which apparently had something to do with the value, because they never did explain to us how the value is determined. Now, we tried some get recourse and how to handle that issue. Yes, we did straighten out the size of the house. We had three assessors walk through it for an hour and a half, and little by little they did change it. But then to look at this sales ratio issue, there is essentially no recourse. We went to the Chisago County Board, or the Lindstrom town board. They did absolutely nothing. They said they couldn't do anything. They didn't know. We went to the Chisago County Board. Again, they didn't even read our... By that time, we had an appraisal. They didn't even read it. So they did absolutely nothing. And we did end up going to district court. We did settle without going to court, essentially. But the process of doing that is this 600 or 700 hours. I am retired. My wife is retired. If we were working 8 hours a day in the business day, the assessor's office is open from 8 to 4:30, Monday through Friday. We could not have spent any time there at all. I spent literally days there digging out information. That part, when you say the market value of the homes in an area, the market value that you have from the assessor has nothing to do with the real market value of the homes in the area. It has nothing to do with it whatsoever. If they're at half on some and double on others, you have no idea where you are. So to use that system to demand payment, and as we've heard, if you can't pay, the county takes the house. That's not fair. That's not honest. It's unconscionable. So something has to be done to get these market value, either get the market value straight, which I don't believe is possible. It is an opinion-based system, and as we heard, it can be just downright fraud.
Mr. Waldron, excuse me, Alan, we're going to have to ask you to kind of wrap things up because we do have another witness and we do have another bill and some people that have come all the way from Moorhead and other areas.
And Mr. Chair, there will be additional opportunity for discussion of assessing when we do the limited market value.
Yeah.
So
if there will be the other witness. Thank you, Mr. Waldron. Do you have some closing statements?
Just thank you very much for hearing me. It is, from our perspective, it is broken beyond comprehension. It's not worth tinkering with. It's worth fixing. And I think the bill before is at least a very good beginning method of getting honest values for the house. Right now, they're too far removed from honesty and fairness.
Thank you. Don Wall from Becker County, please. Please identify yourself for the tape and begin your testimony, Mr. Wall.
I'm Don Wall. I've lived up here in Minnesota for about 10 years. I'm a retired military and chose this place to live. My basic problem here, I think, is that any system that allows an assessor to assess his own property and that of his relatives is open to abuse. And even if it's not abuse, it has the look of abuse. And we're talking about taxing system, and to make any taxing system successful, the people have to trust the people that set the taxes. If they don't, they have a big tendency to cheat. The problem is, a lot of it is, that's a problem, and then any system that that has rules and regulations that the average person can't understand, the average person, nobody can understand most of these. I would bet you that 99% of the people in the county I'm in, or probably other counties, don't have any idea what a printout is. The printout tells you what the property taxes are and why they're there, and there's different categories and so forth, and it tells how much they are. And 100% of the people don't understand it, even if they've got a printout in front of them, because it's so complex that they simply can't do it, so they can't object. You can't object to something you don't know anything about. But when you read one of these printouts, you've got to accept what the assessor tells you, unless you've gone to school and become an assessor. Les can read one. I can't, and I've been playing around with this now for 8-9 years. And I still can't. Even if you take the book, the regulations are so complex and so big you can't understand it. So what you have is a system where nobody understands it, don't understand how you arrive at these taxes. You really have to accept what they give you. And the big problem here is that it penalizes those people who have property that accelerates in value simply because of no fault of their own, nothing that they do, simply because of where it is. The property I'm on, my land that I have my house on, in 10 years has increased 500%. That's a pretty big increase. It's not just because it's Lakeland. Anytime you have a city that's expanding, the people have the same problem. The land becomes more valuable, and they have nothing to do with this. There's nothing they can do about it. And they've selected a place that they want to stay for the rest of their life. They shouldn't be required to move just simply because they're being taxed off the land. So there should be some system that would do this, and I think the income type based on it, in fact, would do that.
Thank you, sir, for coming down and testifying. Representative Vanderveer.
Yes, Mr. Chair, and I'll just close with saying that I was out actually door knocking, contrary to my opponent's campaign literature, one day, and I met a lady who had the original homestead in Centerville, or one of them, and her home, she was about 80 years old, happened to be on Centerville Lake. And because of that location and that situation, she was forced to sell it, and it had been in her family for 150 years. And, you know, we do have a problem, you know, that we haven't gotten to the bottom of yet with regard to the assumption that property tax and income are related. So with that, members, I'll close.
Final questions for Representative Vanderveer? Representative Krenke.
I would just like to take credit or blame, whichever members may want to give, that Mr. Hammerston is my constituent, and I think it was 12 years ago, something like that, that in order to learn more about property taxes and the like, I set up a little citizen task force of constituents in the northern suburban area to look at property taxes, and so we've learned a lot over the last 12 years, haven't we, Marlo?
I often wonder if we did.
we haven't necessarily moved the ball too far down the field, but we've learned a lot. So again, I appreciate all the work that Mr. Hammerston and others have done on this issue, and appreciate Representative Vanderveer's authoring the legislation.
Thank you. Representative Vanderveer renews his motion on House File 992 to be laid over for possible inclusion in the omnibus tax bill. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed say nay. Motion does prevail. Next bill up is House File 1041, Representative Blanding.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members. I would like to move House File 1041, that it be recommended to pass and be laid over for possible inclusion in the division report.
Okay, Mr. Representative Lanning moves that House File 1041 be considered for possible inclusion in the Property and Local Tax Division report. Representative Lanning.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. This bill provides incentives to retain and attract business development in cities bordering the state of North Dakota. The cities that are affected with this legislation are East Grand Forks, Breckenridge, Dilworth, Ortonville, and the city of Moorhead. And you will note that co-authors of this bill are Representatives Marquardt, Leader, and Peterson, who represent those other communities. Let me give you a little bit of history on the issue that this bill directs itself to. If you go back to the late 70s and early 80s, we had a very serious problem in our part of Minnesota with fiscal disparities over against the state of North Dakota. And at one point during that period of time, in the city of Moorhead, a city at the time of about 30,000 people, we had 500,000 square feet of vacant commercial industrial property. That's a whopping amount of square footage of vacant because businesses had left our community. We were losing population. We estimate that we lost up to 15% of our population during that period. Our school enrollment went from over 7,000 to just over 4,000. We closed 7 schools in the span of just a few years. And needless to say, this was a critical time during our history, and I served on the city council and mayor during this era and dealt with this whole issue of fiscal disparities on a daily basis. Well, we came to the state of Minnesota, and the state responded by providing some targeted relief to deal with the fiscal disparities that we were facing. And the Enterprise Zone, the Border City Program, was adopted. And it has been renewed. The appropriation has been renewed now in each of the past 9 biennia, starting in 1983. The effect of this legislation has been very positive. We, as a result of this targeted relief, have been able to stabilize conditions. We've regained a lost population and are experiencing modest growth. Our school enrollment is back over 5,000 now, still well below where we were at the peak. There is still, even though things have stabilized and things are better than they once were, there still is a crying need for this in our community and the other bordering communities. The border cities on the other side of the border have continued to experience phenomenal growth. I wish that each of you could take a tour of what's happening on the North Dakota side versus the Minnesota side and just see the phenomenal growth that is equal to the fastest growing communities in Minnesota, here in the metro area, Rochester, St. Cloud, and we're struggling to get every bit of growth that that we can. And so the need is still there, and we are respectfully requesting that this program be renewed again. It calls for a biennial appropriation of $1.5 million. $750,000 would be for the Enterprise Zone and the other for the Development Zone. And I want to point out that in the last session when we passed this bill, the Tax Committee, those of you who were on the committee remember this, we passed the bill. Chair Abrams asked for a study to be undertaken. And the results of that came back showing just what kind of a struggle we were having in competing with our neighbors to the west. So with that, Mr. Chairman, I have the current mayor of the city of Moorhead who is here and would like to also provide testimony.
Mr. Representative
Mayor Mark Boxland.
Boxland, you state your name and what you do for the record, please.
Good morning, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. I'm Mark Voxland. I'm the mayor of the city of Moorhead, and I'm here to testify in support of House File 1041, a bill appropriating funds for the Border City Enterprise Zone Program and the Border City Development Zone Program. These programs are essential for keeping the cities of Moorhead, East Grand Forks, Dilworth, Hortonville, and Breckenridge competitive with their North Dakota neighbors. I'd like to thank Representative Lanning of Moorhead for authoring and Representative Marquardt of Dilworth for co-authoring this bill. Border City Enterprise Program was enacted in 1983 based on the Minnesota State Planning Study that analyzed competitive factors between Minnesota and North Dakota. The study showed that border cities were suffering great business migrations due to workmen's compensation and property tax disparities. The program has been very successful. In the case of the city of Moorhead, most of the enterprise zone credits have gone to citywide businesses as job credits based on workmen's compensation expenses. Major beneficiaries have been manufacturers and processors, heavy equipment contractors, and major retailers. There are currently 175 businesses in our citywide program. The city has also used the program for special incentives, including providing sales tax credit to large economic development projects. The Border Cities development zones are based on a very successful Michigan Renaissance Zone and tax incentive programs that are provided in North Dakota. The program grants tax exemptions to properties to help reduce the tax disparity between Minnesota and North Dakota tax rates. The programs are still needed. While workmen's compensation costs have been reduced in recent years as a result of legislative reform, competitive pressure with North Dakota remains. Disparities continue, especially for jobs paying more than $16,100, as North Dakota rates are capped at that level, while Minnesota rates use the full salary number to compute the premium. For example, a North Dakota employer would pay an annual premium of $758 for a $35,000 a year electrician, while Minnesota's signed risk premium for that same electrician is $2,975, approximately 292% higher. This is quite close to home. This is what I do for a living. I'm an electrical contractor based in Moorhead. In the past several years, Fargo, North Dakota has attracted two Marvin window expansions and a large service center for First Bank and for Cargill, which have created over 2,000 jobs. The business cost disparities remain significant. Therefore, enterprise zone and development zone programs remain vital to the retention and expansion of our commercial industrial businesses along Minnesota's western border. I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Representative Lanning, thank you for bringing this witness, a mayor with a job. That's a treat.
Novel idea.
Any questions, members? Representative Marquardt. Yeah.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I first would like to note that the two gentlemen sitting at that table represent the mayorship in Moorhead since 1979. So the last 26 years, you've seen the two Moorhead mayors there. Yeah. First of all, Representative Lanning, thank you for bringing this bill forward, and thank you, Mayor Voxland. As the mayor in Dilworth for a number of years, the Border Cities legislation has been an excellent economic tool for Border Cities, and it really has helped level the playing field in a number of situations. And I know in Dilworth it helped to not only attract some businesses, but to retain businesses. And now you still have the workers' comp issue, and you have the property tax exemptions over on the North Dakota side, and some other things. So, as mentioned by the testifiers, this is still legislation that is very important and very much needed in our area. And again, thank you for bringing this forward.
Representative Krenke.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mayor, could you, Representative Lanning, not being a great student of the Job Z legislation, can you give me an idea of what the difference between this enterprise zone legislation is and Job Z?
I'll have our city manager maybe give you a better feel for it. But one of the basic differences I could say as a business owner is, several of the things that are in the border cities have to do with those businesses that are already in place, trying to keep them from making that decision, like I could make, to move virtually less than a mile and save substantially on business expenses. But introduce Bruce Messold, our city manager.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, Representative Krenke. My name is Bruce Messel, and I serve as city manager in Moorhead, and I don't have a real job, so I'm still looking for one. With respect to your question, there's really three significant differences. First of all, as you know, the Job Z zones are geographic-based, and they're set geographic areas that have to be approved through the Department of Employment and Economic Development. The Border Cities legislation in general, these two programs, are not geographic based. They can go within the confines of the cities that are part of the program. Second, of course, is that the Border Cities legislation targets very specific businesses, manufacturing, and the like. The Border Cities Development Enterprise Zones can be used for various other businesses that aren't included in the Jobs Aid legislation. And then third, and perhaps most importantly for us, is these programs are used primarily to address very key differences that have been identified through research and history with the North Dakota competition, in particular workman's compensation and related factors. The final thing I would note is they are also exclusive. The two programs are not overlaid at this time. So a business, if it goes into our Job Z subzone, cannot access these programs. If they are not in the job zone, these are available to them.
Representative Cranky.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. First, I should also mention to the mayor, I'm an electrical contractor as well, so there's one more person that has a real job. Although we haven't been doing very well lately, I might add the maybe I can move into a development zone up in Moorhead. But
we would welcome you. We would welcome you.
The other question would go to Representative Lanning. I presume, Representative Lanning, you're also offering some legislation to help us be more competitive in our work comp rates in Minnesota.
Representative Lanning, I would fully support. I have, Mr. Chairman, Representative Cranky, I have fought many workers' comp battles over the years and have worked hard many times in the past to do so, and I welcome any further look at reform that would bring some relief.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Lanning, I know you wouldn't appreciate the fact that you'd never suggest that we raise taxes on the rest of the state in order to accomplish something here for the maybe some of the funding for your bill.
Mr. Chairman,
Representative Lanning,
let me make this point. With every business that we lose, be it a business that moves or a business that chooses not to locate here and locate in North Dakota, instead, for every resident that decides to live on the other side of the river, Minnesota, not just Moorhead or Breckenridge or Dilworth, loses. The state of Minnesota loses. And I would like nothing better than to just get an estimate of how many millions and millions of dollars the state of Minnesota has lost over time in sales tax, income tax, corporate tax, as a result of the competitive disadvantage we're under. And so if you're going to help us retain and attract business to our communities, Minnesota is going to benefit, not just our communities.
Representative Lanning, well put. Any other questions from members? Anyone else here who would care to testify for or against House File 1041? Do you have any additional comments, Representative Lanning, either your witnesses?
Just to note, we did pass out some information for you. I think it's very interesting to see some of the differences that the state of Minnesota faces when they're dealing with the state of North Dakota. And we've tried to at least outline these a little bit for you.
Representative Cranky.
Excuse me, Mr. Chairman. Thank you. Just to that point, I noticed in the information that you handed out, maybe this is better answered by the city manager, the North Dakota program of Renaissance Zones, again, forgive my lack of knowledge about Job Z versus Renaissance Zone, but could you give me just your quick take on the differences then between what the competition you face with Renaissance Zones versus Job Z in Minnesota?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Cranky, thank you for the question. What I will tell you is, in fact, North Dakota modeled their Renaissance Zone legislation after actually the Border Cities program, which was on the books for quite a while. The Renaissance program is exceptionally aggressive. As you note in the highlights, first of all, it applies to residential improvements and residential properties. So in the case of downtown Fargo, for instance, they have put in a very large area of their downtown for revitalization where individual income tax can be exempted for residential properties. They have seen a tremendous influx, therefore, of people moving back into downtown Fargo and actually out of Moorhead, simply because now they get individual income tax exemptions. The second point is, of course, it is also individual versus the corporate income tax. The other credits that we list here are on top of the Renaissance Zones. Most of the Minnesota programs are either or. So if you qualify, then you apply to the sliding scale to get your qualifications. North Dakota has been very successful in layer-caking their approaches to incentivizing businesses and now residential condominium developments in their downtown. The last thing I would note also is in relationship to the Job Z, which obviously doesn't cover residential and is geared towards the manufacturing sector, the businesses in the Border Cities programs still pay Minnesota property taxes. The ones in Job Z do not, and also in the Renaissance Zone, they do not as well.
Thank you.
Representative Lanning, does this bill just simply abate property tax? Is that primarily what it does?
Mr. Chairman, that's what the city of Moorhead is currently doing primarily. Over time, it's varied. Other times in the history, it's been used more for offsetting workers' comp rates and other job credits for job retention and creation. Different cities have used the program differently, and perhaps Mr. Messelt might be able to speak to that as well.
Mr. Messelt.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. The two primary focuses of the program are to buy down workers' compensation differences, and we do that on a per-business basis. Approximately $25,000 is available maximum for any individual business. The rest of the program that we utilize it for is for reducing the percentage of the CI tax that is applied to try to get it as close as possible to the North Dakota rate. Other cities have used it more on a per-business basis or on selective development basis, but I can't speak definitively for the other four communities at this time. Mr. Chairman, if you'd like, I could do some research and prepare some additional information for you.
I'm not sure that would be necessary, but does the city do anything beyond this, or could this, could they do anything beyond this similar type of incentives using their own dollars?
Mr. Chairman, we do. The city tries to augment as much as it can with its own resources in the areas that are available. We do have, for instance, in certain development projects, we've also incentivized with our utilities. In a couple of cases, we've lost businesses because of that. But in essence, for the significant heavy lifting, the state has been the major funder. As you recall from previous discussions, Moorhead is a property tax poor community, and our rates, our property tax rates are quite high. We've been fortunate to see those reduced, but in the case of CI, we were at 3.9%, of course, and Minnesota or North Dakota is at 2.6. So there was a significant tax differential there that needed to be made up.
Okay, and I think the two mayors since 1979, was it, helped you do that? Sounds like so. Any other comments or questions from members? See none. The chair will lay over House File 1041 for possible inclusion in the Property and Local Tax Division report. And would Representative Marquardt, would you care to move the minutes from the March 9th meeting?
Mr. Chair, so moved.
Okay. Any additions or deletions? Okay. All in favor of approving the minutes from March 9th, 2005, signify by saying aye.
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 All opposed? Motion carries. The minutes.